This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
For all the challenges we face, the growing threat of climate change could define the contours of this century more dramatically than any other.
President Obama today in Paris at the start of the 21st UN Conference on Climate Change. Heads of state and delegates from nearly 200 nations are gathering for 2 weeks of make or break talks on global warming. Here's Christiana Figueres, the organizer of the Paris Climate Conference.
Never before has a responsibility so great been in the hands of so few. The world is looking to you. The world is counting on you.
Well, we'll be watching developments at the Climate Change Conference all this week in a special series on the Paris talks and on Boston's readiness or lack thereof for global warming. And to start us off from Paris is Adel Najem. He's Dean of the School of Global Studies at Boston University and Professor of International Relations and Earth and the Environment. He's also part of the Pakistan delegation at the Paris talks. Dean Najem, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much.
Well, first of all, let's start with a little bit more from what President Obama said in Paris this morning.
What should give us hope that this is a turning point? That this is the moment we finally determined we would save our planet? Is the fact that our nations share a sense of urgency about this challenge and a growing realization that it is within our power to do something about it.
So, Adel Najem, do you get a sense that the other heads of state share that sense of urgency that the president was speaking about?
I think many do. I think many also have a great sense of concern, and all of those were presented in this amazing marathon of speeches by nearly 150 heads of state going on simultaneously in two halls. And it was rather interesting seeing all these leaders being forced to restrict themselves to short, but very powerful, a number of them very powerful speeches, probably the most powerful being from President Obama.
Oh, interesting. Well, first of all, let's take a step back and just talk a little bit about what the goal is overall of the Paris conference. It seems as if the UN has endorsed a goal of limiting or trying to limit global warming to no more than 2 degrees centigrade over pre-industrial levels by the end of this century. Is that realistic?
Many people think it's not realistic. Many others, including myself, believe it is not enough, especially a lot of number of developing countries, particularly the most vulnerable countries such as island states and states with very climatically fragile coastal systems, are arguing that 2 degrees is too much. That even if globally 2 degrees is the goal, for them it will mean catastrophe, and for many of them they claim it will mean a question of survival. Therefore, they are pushing for a 1.5 degree target, and that is going to be one of the big contentions in the next 11 days, because that issue between 1.5 and 2 is going to come up. And what is also going to come up is that all the pledges, and these they are not pledges, all the intended actions that countries are talking about do not add up to even anywhere near 2 degrees.
Uh-huh.
So you have a goal that's probably not going to be met and that many think is not enough.
Interesting. Okay, so you are there in part with the Pakistan delegation. And, you know, while we could spend a lot of time focusing on the United States and China, you know, the big emitters, I want to talk with you a little bit about the tension between developed and developing nations. And let's listen to another clip from President Obama's speech this morning. You said it was amusing to hear heads of state being cut off by a bell telling them to end their speech. So we're going to hear a little bit of that in this clip. But he does also talk about the fact that President Obama believes that developed countries need to aid developing countries in dealing with climate change. Let's listen.
Let's also make sure that these resources flow to the countries that need help, preparing for the impact of climate change that we can no longer avoid. We know the truth that many nations have contributed little to climate change, but will be the first to feel its most destructive effects.
So Adil Najam, with that in mind, I also wanted to read to you something that the Prime Minister of India wrote in the Financial Times yesterday. Uh-huh. He wrote that justice demands that with what little carbon we can still safely burn, developing countries are allowed to grow. The lifestyles of a few must not crowd out opportunities for the many still on the first steps of the development ladder. This is a fundamental tension that could stand in the way of any agreement, isn't it?
It is very much. And it's really not surfaced as much in the last year as it usually does. And I suspect it will here. Now, both those statements were rather interesting. The joke I heard amongst some literally heads of state was that bell during President Obama's speech was rather indicative that as soon as something of importance to developing countries came up, time ran out. And that was said somewhat cynically. And the statement from India becomes important because historically it's been a leader of developing countries. And that is now in question. On the one hand, it is a major emitter. It acts as a major industrial power. Its policy is as such. And yet it is also claiming this mantle of developing country leadership. So that is going to be seen because those interests are beginning to diverge. And especially many of the really small economies, island economies, are seeing that tension. So the question of who is a developing country, the question of who defines developing country interests, whether it's the old giant like China and India, or these vulnerable, climatically vulnerable states, is going to be a big one. Now, all the industrialized country leaders had very, very powerful rhetoric on supporting other countries. Premier Trudeau from Canada did. The UK Prime Minister had very powerful lines. But the question is that they were vague and there aren't any numbers involved and they are sort of a promise to help. And what the developing countries are saying is that they don't want help as much as a legal system, a rule-based system for loss and damage, that loss and damage that they might suffer because of consequences that come from emissions in richer countries should somehow recompensate it.
Well, and how likely is that for the developed nations to support that?
It's nearly unlikely. This becomes a question of justice, and it is very, very unlikely. But that is going to be the tenor of the debate, I presume, especially in the early days as things get sorted out. Mm. But we're going to hear about it. It is very unlikely, but what that also means is that many countries will be very disappointed. Even those who think it is unlikely will be disappointed because for them, it is a question of justice.
Okay. Well, let's play one last piece of tape from President Obama's speech this morning, because I think in a way he is sensing the fact that it's not time to look at this conference through rose-colored glasses. So let's listen.
One of the enemies that we'll be fighting at this conference is cynicism. The notion we can't do anything about climate change. Our progress should give us hope during these 2 weeks. Hope that is rooted in collective action.
Now, Adil Najam, you've been to previous climate conferences in Denmark, in Kyoto, in Berlin. Not all of them ended in an agreement. So circling back to where we started, I mean, is the president right to call out the forces of cynicism in Paris this week?
I sense he's speaking directly to me. None of them ended in agreement. And that's the tragedy. These negotiations have been going on for literally 25 years. On the last day of this conference will mark the exact quarter century of these negotiations. And there isn't really an agreement per se. The nearest we came to was Kyoto. And that ended up in a mess with many countries making binding pledges that they went on not to implement. So that has left a lot of cynicism, if you want, but also a lot of distrust on whether good intentions can be turned into actual actions. So there are people, me included, who are kind of tired after a quarter century of these negotiations and would rather want to see concrete action, real numbers, real legally binding rules that come out of it, and real mechanisms for making them be implementable.
Well, Adil Najm is Dean of the Pardee School of Global Studies at Boston University. He's also part of the Pakistan delegation at the Paris Climate Conference, speaking to us from Paris. Dean Najm, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, let's turn now from the global to the local, because, of course, the effects of climate change are felt everywhere, including here in Massachusetts and the greater Boston area. So joining us now with more is David Cash. He's Dean of the McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies at UMass Boston. Mr. McCormick, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
So first of all, you wrote in an op-ed in the Boston Globe over the weekend that, quote, never have the global and the local been more closely linked or more symbiotic. What did you mean by that?
So what I meant is that we're, I think, as President Obama said, and I think as Dean Najm meant as well, is that there is a turning point right now. And if and when an agreement comes through, there's no question that the implications of that are going to play out at local, state and local levels. And in fact, one could argue that the majority of the actions are going to happen at those levels.
Regardless of if there's an agreement.
And
right?
Regardless of if there's an agreement. There has not been an agreement for 25 years. And we've seen places like Germany and Massachusetts and California and India as well that have, and China, that have embraced a clean energy future in a way that I don't think was predicted. Mm. And the kinds of innovations, innovations of policy, innovations of technology, innovations of marketing, of financing, are all going to happen at these lower levels.
Well, in fact, we've already seen some of that innovation over time right here, you know, in the Northeast, with, for example, with the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. There's also, you know, a push for net metering. And then you also have written about the economic benefits of green power. So tell us a little bit more about how that is playing out right now in Massachusetts.
Sure, I will. And I imagine I have obviously not listened to all the speeches this morning, and there was obviously speeches about urgency and the major impacts. But I will bet you that there was a lot of discussion about seizing economic opportunities right now with at this point in time. About 8 or so years ago, when Governor Patrick first came in, and I was lucky enough to be part of his team that was working on energy and environment and climate change, he looked at this and the team looked at it as Massachusetts, with its technical capabilities, its universities, et cetera, had some real opportunities. And the fact that we're at the end of the energy pipeline, figuratively and literally. Mm-hmm. And we launched a wholesale reformation of our energy policy, energy pricing, energy incentives. As you mentioned, we joined the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, which is an emissions trading program, which essentially says to emitters, you have to pay to emit. And that money goes back to the states where it lowers people's bills and it pays for energy efficiency and solar, et cetera. We launched a program that allowed solar to grow from 3 megawatts to over 900 megawatts today.
Well, if I can just jump in here for a second, because it all sort of amounts to something which I find quite surprising, actually, that now in Massachusetts there are 100,000 clean energy jobs, and it's there's been a 10% in that 10% growth in that sector in the past 6 years?
10% each year for the last 6 years.
Past 6 years.
Exactly.
Okay. But what about the flip side to that? Mm-hmm. Because I think, you know, as we're talking about, there are a lot of arguments to be made that most of the, or a lot of the innovation when it comes to fighting climate change and being ready is going to come from the state, local, or regional level, as we've been discussing. But on the other hand, there are also continued barriers to really getting mm-hmm. us to where we need to be. Because I'm thinking when it comes to other forms of clean energy, wind, solar, et cetera, oftentimes if they face a problem that any startup does, that the initial costs are really high. And so therefore, maybe big corporations or companies or, you know, utilities themselves don't want to invest in them in the way they should be.
Mm-hmm. Right. So that's exactly part of the point of linking the global to the local and everything in between. Because those jurisdictions that have moved very aggressively have looked at those kinds of rules, have looked at those kinds of incentives. In fact, our utilities in this state were not very well incentivized to do energy efficiency because every kilowatt hour they sold, that's what how they made their money. We flipped the regulations so that they were essentially paid for helping their customers save electricity. And it was only after that that Massachusetts vaunted to number one in the country on energy efficiency and started installing solar and wind in the way that I've described.
Mm. And what about the fact that we're still in a world right now where the cheapest form of energy, or one of the cheapest, is still natural gas?
So there's no question that natural gas is going to play a very important role moving forward, but it has to play a bridging role because it's cheapest in how it's determined right now. It doesn't take into account all of the costs that using it impact on the environment, on our health, et cetera. And that's, you know, the conversation that Dean Najum was talking about in terms of the countries that are going to be most impacted. Those costs are astronomical, and our fossil fuel companies don't tag those on to the price that you pay. So part of this whole notion of a cap and trade program or these commitments that countries are making is leveling the playing field.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because we here in Massachusetts and thinking of greater Boston or anywhere near the water in particular, like we're going to everyone's going to feel the effects some sooner than others. But I'm wondering, I mean, I'm also seeing statistics that say that just 8 states, including Massachusetts, represent more than 99% of all solar installations. So, you know, it's on the one hand, like we regionally can do as much as possible. But what difference does it make if these technologies don't really spread to a point of critical mass?
Well, that's exactly the fight that many of us have been fighting for years. And that's exactly why what's happening in Paris is so important, because it will put a umbrella over this effort that's going to be very hard for large companies, small companies to deny that these changes are coming down the pike. And even you see in places, for example, Texas, not a state that particularly supports addressing climate in any kind of aggressive way. It's one of the largest wind states. It's figured out how to make the market fair for wind, and wind can play there. And so I think we're going to see this all over the world. I happened to be in India last spring. And in fact, the state that was one of the most aggressive was Prime Minister Modi's state that he had governed, Gujarat. And they had started getting the rules right. And even though, as you discussed, the Prime Minister is looking at coal as a cheap source to pull the 300 million people out of energy poverty, he also sees that the future is going to be in solar and wind. And solar and wind and electric vehicles that are designed and created by engineers in India.
Well, David Cash is Dean of the McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies at UMass Boston. He's also former commissioner of the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection. He will be attending the Paris Climate Conference next week as well. David Cash, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
There's more of the show in just a minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.